And welcome everyone to a very special episode of Podcasting Them Softly. This is Nick, and of course I'm joined by Frank. What's going on, buddy?
Not much, man.
I know we're both pretty excited tonight. We're very lucky to be joined by special guest Josh Olson. Josh is the Oscar, BAFTA, and Writers Guild nominated writer of the David Cronenberg crime thriller A History of Violence, which Frank and I are both huge fans of. We're very excited to talk to him about that. Josh has also written an episode of Masters of Science Fiction with the legendary Harlan Ellison, was the last writer on Halo when it was being worked on with Peter Jackson and Neil Blomkamp. And he's worked on scripts with Slash, Willie Nelson, and Mick Jagger, as well as writing one of the segments of the animated anthology series Batman Gotham Knights. His Village Voice piece, I Will Not Read Your Fucking Script, received more than 5 million hits and refuses to die. And he is currently developing a Western TV show with the great director Walter Hill, which I know Frank and I will want to talk to him about at the end. He's also a massive film buff, having provided numerous commentaries for the excellent website Trailers from Hell. And on our show tonight, we're going to discuss our favorite underrated movies from really any genre and just kind of talk about some stuff that slipped through the cracks possibly, because we know Josh is a big fan of those kind of movies. So thanks a lot for joining us, Josh. It's going to be a really fun chat.
My pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you again for coming on the show. This is very exciting for us because we get to talk about history and violence, and plus we get to talk about underrated films, which I know for film buffs like us, that's a very fun subject to geek out about.
Oh yeah.
So,
I was going to say that there never seems to be any sort of shortage of them either.
I guess we'll start with A History of Violence because Nick and I love it so much, and I had an obsession with that film when it came out, and I saw it in theaters, and it was one of the only films that I can think of in recent memory that kind of left me without anything to say after I saw the film. I saw it with one of my buddies, and we walked out of the theater, and we both looked at each other, and it's like, I don't even know where to begin. So I had read the graphic novel a long time ago when the film came out. I don't own it, unfortunately. I was looking for it the other day. But from my recollection, there is some differences, particularly with Richie. But how did the genesis of that begin?
Well, it was interesting. I've been writing kind of low-budget, straight-to-video thrillers for a while. I've had fortune or misfortune to kind of fall into that world with the first script I ever sold. Ended up being made by New Image with Casper Van Dien. It was a sad story because it started out, we had, I think Peter Medak was interested in directing it, and we had, good Lord, I'm blanking. Stephen Ray and Gabriel Byrne, I guess they weren't formally attached, but they were looking like they were going to do the film. And then New Image got involved somehow, and Medak left, and they left, and I ended up with Casper Van Dien. And that was the next few years of my life, kind of writing in that world, because once you're in, it's hard to get out. But I had sold, while I was writing all these, you know, Eric Roberts Hitman movies, by day for the great Mark Lester, director of Commando and Bobby Joe and the Outlaw and many other wonderful films. I was writing spec scripts, and I sold one to Paramount, and that kind of gets you in a different game. Everyone's sort of always very excited to kind of meet the new people, you know, who's the hot new writer this weekend or whoever. And so that kind of got me into New Line. I had a connection over there. There was an executive who had been several years earlier my first agent's assistant. And he actually knew I had read History of Violence, and he was now a big exec at New Line, and called me up and was like, you know, hey, now that you're kind of studio approved, I can bring you in for stuff. Do you want to come pitch a take on History of Violence? He said, no, I got to tell you up front, we're only talking to about four or five, you know, big A-list writers who are all friends of the head of the studio. So you're not going to get the job, but you know, I want you to come in so that, you know, my guys will get a sense of you, they'll like you, and then I can bring you in on something where you have a chance later, and then you'll be familiar to them. I thought, okay, that's an interesting proposition. But it's what it meant, and it was an incredibly valuable lesson, is that I wasn't under a huge amount of pressure to deliver what I thought they wanted, which would be sort of a straight up adaptation of the book. And I had read the book and enjoyed it a lot. I, you know, it was one of those things where I wish I'd come up with that title and that premise. And if I had come up with that title and that premise, I would have done something a bit different. So it was kind of licensed to do that and kind of follow my passion on it, to essentially plagiarize, you know what I mean? since I wasn't going to get the job, it didn't matter that I was going to change everything up. And so I went in and I pitched it, and a friend called me up and he was like, yeah, you did a great job. You're not going to get the job, but, you know, it's, but they really liked you. And calls me up a couple days later. He's like, hey, you did a great job. You're not going to get the job, but it's down to you and two other guys. And you know, now it's down to you and one other guy, but you're not going to get the job. And he calls me up a couple days later. He's like, hey, you got the job. so it kind of came from it. It was a really valuable lesson. It was like, you've got to, you know, you can't try to second guess them, and you can't do the thing you think they want, because at least I can't. You have to just kind of do the thing that makes you happy as a, God help me for using the word, but makes you happy as an artist. I did. What was amazing to me is that what I pitched, the differences between what I pitched and what eventually got made are so slight. It's ridiculous. The thing I kept expecting them to change was the ending. The book, I'll run you out really quick for people who haven't read it, but who have seen the film. In the book, Vigo's character is not a former gangster at all. He's this kid who lives in this bad neighborhood in New York. He and his friend Richie fell afoul of the mob. They found a guy, some kind of ex-Marine or something, I can't remember, who takes them out into the woods and teaches them how to be, you know, badass gunfighters, essentially. And then they come back and they kill all these mob guys. And Richie gets caught by the mob, and Tom takes off and has been hiding for 20 years. And in the end of it, instead of, you know, Richie being one of the bad guys, he finds out later after he's caught and they come to get him. He finds out that Richie, the mob has kept Richie in a warehouse for 20 years. They have burned him, cut off his arms and legs, and they're hanging him from a meat hook where they torture him. They torture him daily.
Yeah, I haven't read the book.
So Tom has to go back to New York to kill all the bad guys and put his friend Richie out of his misery. And it actually reminded me in the best way possible of the kind of stuff I was writing, you know, for Eric Roberts and Mark Lester. And I thought there were kind of all these questions about, you know, kind of character and identity that were raised by the book, but that it didn't seem interested with. And so I kind of started focusing on that stuff. Like, you know, who are you really? If you're, you know, if you've been living a lie for 20 years, isn't that who you are really? And what happens to a family when they find out that, you know, dad is not who he says he is? In the book, they're all kind of thrilled to find out that dad was a badass, and that's about it for repercussions. I thought probably there would be more consequences to it than that. And I just thought it would be kind of more interesting to make him, you know, not the super heroic guy, but, you know, a bad guy who's trying to become a better person. So it all kind of came out of that. And I felt like, you know, the story I wanted to tell needed to end with an ending that left some questions. And again, since I wasn't going to get the job, I pitched them a very non-Hollywood ending. But once I got the job, I really did. I kept expecting the first, you know, they would call up and go, oh, by the way, we need an ending that answers all the questions. And it never happened, which was crazy. But yeah, New Line was wonderful to work with.
And how did David Cronenberg get involved?
He, it was the bumpiest period of the process. He, or just the most tension filled, at least for me. I handed in my first draft. The studio loved it. They started going out looking for directors. And there was a couple months there where a lot of people were coming in, some good folks, and they come in, and it felt like everybody who came in, this is a thing in our business, everybody who came in would pitch, you know, all the changes they wanted to make to the story. And some of them were pretty extreme, and I'd just be sitting there going, God damn it. Because it's very rare that you actually know you hit it, you know? And I felt pretty strongly that I had actually done, you know, what I set out to do, and that it was pretty good. And all these people kept coming in, and they want to change this and change that, and, you know, tell it all in flashback and all kinds of stuff. And I was just getting more and more anxious about what was going to happen to this. And then out of the blue, I guess Cronenberg had just done Spider, which is a great film.
Yeah.
Very non-commercial. You know, it's Ralph Fiennes wandering around London for 2 hours, you know, gibbering schizophrenically.
Yeah, mumbling. It's a very underrated movie. It can tie into our conversation later.
Absolutely. And but I think David, I know David was looking to sort of get back into the game where, you know, he's just frustrated by how much time it took to raise, you know, money to make that kind of film, and wanted to get back into sort of a more, I think, lucrative game and make something that people would see. And so he read the script. He asked his agents to send him, you know, more commercial studio fare. Read the script, loved it. They got in touch with New Line, and there was this long period. And look, I understand from their point of view. You know, I suspect you and I, you guys all share my affection for David's films. You know, to me, it's a no-brainer. But, you know, if you're running a studio, you've got other concerns besides just making good films and great directors. You've got to make movies that make money. And, you know, considering I think Spider grossed about $650,000, not that it was ever meant to make a shit ton of money, you know what I mean? It's not that kind of film. Right. But they were a little anxious. So it was a really long process of him kind of meeting with them a lot and pushing for it. And I behaved pretty nefariously. I had a great relationship with the studio, and they would tell me, you know, what was going on with the process, and constantly be like, you know, don't tell anyone, but here's what happened today. And this guy came in and he said that, and here's how we're feeling about Cronenberg right now. And I'd be like, oh, okay, I won't tell anyone. And then I'd call up David's agent and tell them everything I knew. Because, God damn it, I wanted David Cronenberg to direct my movie. And then finally, so that was a long period. Everything else in this project, from writing it to getting it made, everything very quick. But that was the longest process. It took months. It was really anxiety-inducing. But they finally, and to their credit, the clincher for them was they sat down, they watched Spider, and they went, holy shit, he's still great. And so David was on, and we then spent a week. He came to L.A., and we sat down in a hotel room, got together every day, and we would go through the script page by page and talk about it, and made several changes to it. Then there was a character that sort of the studio suggested putting this guy in. I didn't love it, but I didn't hate it. And, you know, it was my first studio gig. I'm not going to. And I feel like I could make it work. They wanted Marie Bella's character to have a father who's a widower who had fought in Vietnam and had his own history of violence. He had been abusive to her mother and so forth. And it was all right, but I remember the first thing David said when he sat down, he's like, I want to get rid of this character. I think he was sort of testing me to see how things were going to go. So instead of easing into it, it was like, let me pull a guy, you know, we're going to start by pulling a character out and see how he takes it. And I was so relieved. I was like, oh, God. And David said something that I really, that boded well for our working relationship. He said, this character is just, he's all about theme. He goes, and I hate theme. I hate writing about themes and writing from themes. And I was just like, fantastic. Because I do too. I think your themes find themselves if you're writing honestly, if you're coming from, you know, if it's organic. But I think if I don't like starting out with a theme, and there's a lot of great movies that do, but there's a lot of really bad ones where you can tell they started out with what they wanted to say and then built on that. And it all drives me nuts. So we got rid of the father-in-law. I remember David saying, we just screwed Robert Duvall out of a job. the kind of two, there were a lot of tweaks here and there. The two big changes, and one of them to this day, I smack myself in the head because it was so friggin' obvious, and I'm so embarrassed that I didn't. In spite of the fact that I kept, you know, I made Richie, you know, he was now this mob boss who had grown up with Tom. They were friends. David goes, you know, they should be brothers. And I was just like, oh, God, of course they should be brothers. You know, I still had that vestige of the book in my head where they're just friends. And it was like, it was so obvious. I felt like an idiot. And then the sex scenes came out of that. I felt that, you know, as a fan of this very distinct director, I wanted it to feel like one of his movies. And there was no way to get, you know, a biological mutation into it. But I thought maybe we could get some sort of, you know, interesting, complex adult, you know, maybe crash style sex into it. And David was very much against that from when I first told him. I said, I want to come up with a way to do that. And he said, no, 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 I don't want it to be too Cronenberg-y. And then, but I kept sort of pushing at it and did the first one, the cheerleader outfit, which was kind of set up the more the darker one that comes later. But that came out of a conversation with David where Maria's character slaps Vigo, and David said, and the scene ended there, and he goes, you know, I think we could go further with this scene. And I thought, oh, this could be where that happens, you know. So those are kind of the big ones, is making him the brother, getting rid of the father, and adding the sex scenes. You know, it's a weird thing for a writer, but you know, I can tell I succeeded with the sex scenes because people kept referring to them as quintessentially Cronenberg, you know.
So yeah, the movie really does have a very upfront, overt sexual manner about it, and that's one of the things that grabbed me the first time I saw the film. To be honest, was both the juxtaposition of the sex and the violence, and just about how in a lot of mainstream movies, I mean, I know you get your obscure, you know, Gaspar Noé's Love notwithstanding and some other things. You don't get movies that have really graphic sex with major stars too often. And I found that was one of the very refreshing things about the movie, is that for, you know, a film that was sort of trading off of genre elements, there was a deeper, you know, message behind the sex and violence, but at the same time, you had it right there still to enjoy.
Still to enjoy, yes. Exactly. Exactly.
Did you guys have any idea this was going to be somewhat of an award season film when you made it?
Yeah, it feels unexpected.
Yeah,
it certainly does.
Answer that. I mean, I certainly didn't. You know, and that was such a weird experience because to me it was like, I never had those fantasies either. You know, I wanted to make, you know, I wanted to make movies that, you know, were the kind of films I liked to see. I wanted to write and make those and reach just enough of an audience that I could keep. That was sort of the goal, was, you know, make enough of a living at it that I could keep, you know, make a living. The idea of making a film that was going to get that kind of mainstream acceptance was not on my mind. I don't think it was on David's. I think he was looking for kind of a big, fat, mainstream hit, which, you know, it was his idea of a big action film. So, it was all kind of a weird surprise when that started happening. But that's a weird thing, too, when, you know, you find yourself in the middle of all that kind of, you know, award season speculation and realize that you legitimately have a shot at that kind of thing. That, you know, when the people who are making the odds are making the odds, they're your name, your film, your actors are in the mix. It's a very weird thing to think, you know, hey, I might get nominated for an Oscar. I never, you know, never crossed my mind after the Casper Van Dien film came out that might happen. Or when I wrote and directed my low budget remake of The Big Chill as a horror film.
Wanted to ask you about, how did William Hurt get involved? Because Frank and I are both big fans. You referenced the, you know, The Big Chill, and You know, we actually, on one of our earliest podcasts, we did our favorite William Hurt performances, and
our first one, actually.
That was the first one. Wow, look at that.
That was our first one, yeah. One of my all-time favorite actors. History of Violence was number two on my performance list, by the way.
Oh, fantastic.
So
we should talk about that in a minute. He just kind of blew everybody. I mean, he got, you know, they approached him. He said yes. I mean, I wasn't.
And so you weren't. Did you have him in mind when you were writing? When the thought became to turn them into brothers, and like
not at all. I did have, what's weird is, you know, I like to write towards actors. It helps you sort of get a feel for a character. And Viggo was one of the two actors I sort of had in mind when I was writing it. I can't take any credit for him ending up in the film. And in fact, it was another actor who initially got cast in the lead, who had to fall out for some other project that suddenly went. And it was, I won't, an actor I absolutely completely love, who I felt was completely wrong for the film. When he dropped out, they went to Viggo and he came in, and it was great because he had, you know, I loved him from, Indian Runner, was where I first really noticed him and was really happy that, the Lord of the Rings movies had put him in a place where, you know, he can now conceivably be brought in to, you know, anchor a studio feature as a star. But William Hurt, no, I didn't. In fact, the thing with that, you know, it's funny. It's such a weird character in so many ways. You know, it's a tough thing to introduce your villain in the third act, to even introduce the idea of that villain, you know? Because they don't even really talk about him, and you don't even really find out he exists until the very end of the film. And it was such a hard job, and I remember, you know, I was up on the set. I went up to visit for a couple of weeks, got to hang out, and I made a point of making sure I was there for some of Bill's scenes. I wanted to see him work, he knows this. I've told him this. You know, I was up there, I was having an amazing time watching all this stuff come together. It was like, Jesus, this incredible cast. I mean, just they were all so good. And Bill came towards the very end of my visit, and then he showed up and did those scenes, and I saw his first take. And I remember just thinking, it's over. It's just over. He was so eccentric. It was so strange. And I was just like, that can't be what David wants. And then they conferred and went back and he did it again. And I was just like, oh, God. And I thought, but, you know, look, it's Cronenberg, it's William Hurt. I got to trust these guys. David showed me the first rough cut of the film, and, you know, I was fine with it. And then Hurt comes on and starts doing his crazy shit. And I'm just like, oh, what the hell happened? But the first time I saw it with an audience, which I think is just, it's the most important thing. You have to watch these things with people. And, yes, I saw it with an audience. And, it was amazing. It played differently, and watching it work, you know, it like really landed with the audience. And it took me one or two more viewings, but it got to the point where I would make a point, because, you know, there were a lot of screenings, especially during award season, where I'd show up and do Q&As afterwards. And I would make a point of showing up early enough that I could show up and get all of his performance, because I enjoyed it so much. And, you know, what he had done is taken the one character in the script that had nothing, that was just kind of words on a page, and he'd invested him with this fantastic character. And, you know, he got, in a way that I didn't, I think that the movie really has to shift tones too at that point, because it's a different world. I mean, just everything about it was so rich and so perfect and so ballsy, because, you know, he had to know there'd be some people who'd be watching that going, what the fuck is he doing?
Right.
You know, and I was just, he knocked me out, finally. and he was such a joy to hang out with. I got to spend some time with him on the set. And he's a really, really interesting, idiosyncratic thinker, and just a fantastic character.
Yeah, that's hands down one of my all-time favorite performances. I think that his performance in that film is one of the be-all, end-all, one-act performances. I can't think off the top of my head, really, of anyone who really had that limited amount of screen time that just completely owns it. I mean, I suppose Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs, if you condense all of his screen time down to the whatever 15 minutes it is, but that's strategically placed throughout the film to where his presence is there the whole time. But I mean, William Hurt in that, oh my God, I could just watch that those scenes over and over and over again.
Me too. He's and I have.
Yeah, I mean, I should say I have too.
yeah, he's amazing. And it was such a, it was such a thrill. I remember walking in. You know, they do this nominees luncheon for all the nominees every year, and I walked in, and there's this, you know, this whole red carpet area, and you're sort of walking through. And it's really crowded going in. I'm walking in the door, I got this hand on my shoulder, and I turn around, and it's William Hurt. He just holds his fist up in his air, and I was just like, yeah, brother, here we are. Here we are. I was so happy that he got that nomination. That's fantastic.
Yeah, that was great. He had a good year that year. He was in Syriana.
Yeah, yep.
I can't remember if he was in something else, but yeah, that was kind of like his rebirthing.
Yeah.
Which was great because he kind of faded into not so much mainstream film or even playing the lead. Not like he has to play the lead, but that film really brought him back.
Yeah.
Which
I think it did.
Very happy for as well.
Yep.
Josh, you had a chance to work on a project that, you know, for a lot of people, I think it was very unfortunate that it didn't get made, which was the Halo movie. And I would love to find out what it was like to be involved with such a project of that magnitude. Now, I'm not a gamer. I'm fully aware of Halo, what it is, the influence it's had on films, television, you know, the whole thing. But I'm really curious to know what it was like to work on such a massive property and sort of what like the development process was like.
It was weird. It was fun. You know, I had this sort of flirtation with stuff like that after History, where sort of all these big projects would come my way. That one was, you know, I'm a screenwriter. I spent a lot of time playing video games. I had played Halo a lot. And I remember when that script went around a couple years earlier, and sort of every now and then I read something about it. Now Peter Jackson was on board and he was either directing it or producing it or whatever. But I got this call that he was going to be in town and they were looking for someone to write. They were going to basically throwing everything out and starting over from scratch. I don't know how many other, there had been a bunch of different scripts. I think they tossed out the first one and then the one after that. I don't know. And he was going to be producing it and he had this director that he had kind of taken under his wing, Neil Blomkamp, who had done some amazing short films and commercials, who was going to direct, and that I want to meet with Peter Jackson. And I will say this honestly, I was, you know, I play video games. I don't necessarily want to write movies based on them. I was way more revved about Peter Jackson than I was about Halo. And I went to the meeting, and my agents basically said it was. They were all fans of my work. And basically this was just sort of a get to know you meeting. And if he and I got along, I'd have the job. And I don't mean this in a vainglorious, egomaniacal way. That made me feel really good because I thought I've been a fan of his from the get go. And, you know, I love his work. I understand where he's coming from. We share a lot of the same interests and influences and all the rest of that. So I was like, I have a sneaking suspicion we're going to get along. We did. We got along great. And the moment came, and I thought about it in advance because I didn't want to get caught. I thought, God damn it, if I'm asked, I'm just going to be completely honest because the worst thing is to get caught in a lie. And he said, do you play the game? I said, yeah, I play the game a lot. He says, and do you watch the cutscenes, you know, the narrative stuff that runs in between shooting people? And I said, I don't. I play the game to shoot people, you know. And he smiled. And he said, ah, you know, me too. And we were off and running. And I went down to New Zealand. I was down there for a few weeks. I was we'd go to Peter's house every day with Neil and Philippa and Fran, and we would sit around and kind of, you know, try to break a story. And during all that, there was all this sort of back and forth with Microsoft and Universal, and I think people have written about this. And then the whole thing just sort of fell apart while we were, you know, just from a deal perspective, while we were trying to come up with a film. So it never happened, but it was a great experience. And I got, you know, I got the tour of Weta from Peter Jackson, which was pretty awesome. And I think my big takeaway from that is that they had, you know, full 3D models of a whole bunch of the characters from Lord of the Rings films and stuff. They all have genitals. I'm not kidding. They have the Balrog, is it, from the first film, that big giant thing that's beating the hell out of them. and they got this big giant Balrog there, and he's got a little pecker hanging out. You're like, oh,
that's interesting.
That's interesting.
Guess we're going for realism.
I mean, these things are pretty common now, but back then, this is, what, 2008 maybe? This was not common. They had a 3D printer, and they were printing a lot of the Halo props, and that was pretty amazing. They had used it on King Kong. That was a cool thing to see in action. Of course, now they're, you know, you can go to Kinko's and get something 3D printed, I guess, but that was very cool. So, but it was fun, and I really, you know, I got to work with Neil a lot, who I really like. I got to see some of the ideas that he wanted to throw into Halo ended up in District 9, which was cool because, you know, he would talk about stuff, and I'd be like, oh yeah, I can sort of, I think I understand what you're talking about, and then you actually see it in the film, and you're like, holy shit, that would have been awesome. It was a fun experience. I wish it had gone all the way.
I think now is a better time than any to segue into, I think what we're all looking forward to is to discuss underrated films. And I know Nick wants to hit it off with Emperor of the North, but before we do that, I'm really curious, what's one of your quintessential underrated films?
Oh man. I don't know. I think it's getting more rated, if you will, but one of my all-time favorites is Charlie Varrick.
Yes.
It's just such a pitch-perfect thriller and so of its time. You know, the notion that Walter Matthau would be the tough, you know, nail-biting lead in a bank robber heist movie. It's fantastic. I love Charlie Varrick, and that. But it's been getting more love over time, I think, which is a nice thing. One of the ones that I'm really on, I'd love to find, while I'm talking to you, I'm Googling because I check every now and then to see if one's up. You know, we can't do Trailers from Hell commentaries if we don't have trailers. There's a film called The Silent Partner. Oh, look, it says there's a trailer here now. Ooh, maybe I can. Do you know this film with Elliot Gould, Christopher Plummer?
Yes.
No, but it sounds awesome. What is this?
Fantastic. It's called Silent Partner. It's from like 1979. It is just fantastic, smart, tight little thriller. And written by Curtis Hanson in the early days of his career.
Yes. Oh, wow.
That's why it's familiar. I've never seen it, but I love Curtis Hanson's work up and down, and I knew that name was familiar or something about it.
It is Elliot Gould plays a bank teller. It's a Canadian film. He's a bank teller, and through a rather ingenious plot mechanism, he realizes that it's Christmas time, that the Santa Claus is out in front of the bank collecting money. He realizes he's planning on robbing the bank. And when he sees the robbery is about to happen, he squirrels away some of the money into his lunchbox for, you know, to keep himself, thinking he'll get away with it. The bank robber makes off with the money and then finds out on the news that he didn't get that they think he got more money than he did, but figures out that the bank teller skimmed the money. and they get involved with this incredible cat and mouse. And it is so smart. And so it's just, it's a wonderful, wonderful film. I've shown it to so many people over the years. I'm actually really psyched. I just looked on YouTube and for the first time, there seems to be a Silent Partner trailer here. So who knows, maybe I get to do a commentary on it.
Yeah, I just looked it up on Amazon and I'm probably going to rent it off of their video service.
Oh yeah.
And it's funny that you brought up Charlie Varrick, because last night my viewing selection was between Prime Cut and Charlie Varrick, both of which I bought on the German Blu-ray, which, by the way, for listeners, the German Blu-rays for some reason are playing in my I have a region free and a regular U.S. Blu-ray player. The German Blu-rays are playing in the U.S. player. So go figure. But yeah, I can't wait to see Charlie Varrick.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Ah, shit, this is not a trailer. Oh, wait, maybe is it a trailer? No, now it's a trailer. Okay, never mind. Oh, no, it's a different movie. God damn it.
Yeah, Charlie Varrick is fantastic. I mean, yeah. I grew up watching a lot of films with my dad, and it was mainly John Wayne, Errol Flynn, Gary Cooper, those type of films. And then when I got a little bit older is when my dad and I would go rent VHS tapes, back when they had VHS tapes at video stores. And we would he'd show me all these films like Point Blank and Monty Walsh and all this Lee Marvin, quintessential 70s stuff. And Charlie Varrick was one of them. The Laughing Policeman was another one. There are all these great films that now seem to be getting this resurgence, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
One of mine would be, this was so hard because when I knew we were doing this, it's like, geez, where do I even begin to compile a list? One of mine is a film called Vigilante, and it came out in 1983. And it was directed by William Lustig.
Oh, William Lustig, sure, yeah. Yep.
And it's got this great cast. It's got Robert Forster, Fred Williamson. It's essentially one of these gritty films about Robert Forster's family gets attacked, wife and kid get murdered by these hoodlums, this gang, and the police can't do anything. And Fred Williamson, Fred the Hammer,
yes,
of course, leads the vigilante group in the neighborhood to take the power back from these hoodlums that are terrorizing everything. It seems like one of these films that kind of got made that hit the same mark that like Assault on Precinct 13 did and Death Wish.
Yep.
It's very violent and, you know, overly gruesome and violent with its nature, like how Assault on Precinct 13 was.
Yeah.
And it's available on Blu-ray from this company called Blue Underground.
Yeah, they do great stuff.
They do. Machine Gun McCain's another one with John Cassavetes,
sure,
and Peter Falk.
Sure.
I own both those on Blu-ray.
That one's sitting on my shelf, Frank, waiting to be watched.
Which one, Machine Gun McCain?
Yeah, I bought that blind. I haven't seen it yet. I just picked it. It was cheap, and I was tired of hearing about it online from everybody.
That was actually one of the first Blu-rays I bought was Machine Gun McCain, because I read about it on a website, High Def Digest, and they talked it up. So, of course, I love John Cassavetes and Peter Falk, and I didn't even know that this, like, subgenre of Italian gangster films, like the, or I should say spaghetti gangster films, was a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Until I saw that, and then I started hitting those hard.
Yeah, no, there's some wild ones. I do a weekly, been doing it for about 15 years now. Every Wednesday, same bunch of idiots come over to my house and we screen a different film. It's always, I don't know, it's taken me 15 years to even come close to figuring out what our aesthetic is, but invariably it's something. It's just, you know, it's stuff that, because everybody here is pretty film literate, so it's got to be kind of slightly off the beaten trail, but yeah, I've got the Blu-ray of Vigilante scheduled for about 3 weeks from now. So, by the way, speaking of VHS, I'm assuming one of you at least is sitting in front of a computer. Do you know that Google the last movie released on VHS?
Okay. The last movie I bought on VHS was Meet the Parents, but hang on.
Just last movie released on VHS.
Okay. Last movie on VHS. Tell me it's A History of Violence or something like that. Hang on. Last movie to be released. Ah, dude! It is A History of Violence. And this post, whatever website I'm on, omgfactsonline.com, has a new VHS shadow box. I fucking want that.
The last movie released on VHS is A History of Violence. That's amazing.
Dude, that's amazing.
The movie could have, I mean, honestly, the movie
I'm buying that out of fucking principle right now. I'm going on eBay.
The movie could have come and gone with zero people seeing it, and you'd still have that, and it would be amazing.
Exactly.
That's totally wild. What were you going to say?
I said, now they're making VHSs again, so it sort of, dampens it,
they're making VHS tapes again?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Mondo makes some.
Oh, that's right, the Mondo series, the artsy ones. Those are very cool. Those are very
cassettes
cool.
Are coming back. Maybe they'll redo laser discs, because I've got a couple of those.
It's an effect for, it's a side effect of the resurgence of vinyl, which actually is a great way to listen to music and probably the best still. But VHS is not the best way to watch movies.
No, I concur.
I would argue.
There is one History of Violence on VHS on eBay for $124.99 or best offer,
yeah,
free ship.
Don't buy that.
That's crazy.
I'll do a picture of mine. It is framed on my wall.
That's awesome.
I think one of the really fun things about discussing movies all day and reading stuff, not now with just so many great websites out there and Facebook and various, online forums and ways to communicate with people, the titles that have come across my lap over the last, year and a half have just been amazing. And it's like my mind's been open up to any number of movies. And I really do want to plug the website that you've been doing this stuff for and a number of really awesome film buffs, happen to work in the industry, writers, directors, producers, Trailers from Hell, this is. And it was really fun seeing one of your picks end up being a movie that I've become kind of like quietly obsessed with, which was Emperor of the North, which is a movie that you state very, very truthfully in your review or critique. It would never get made these days. This is a hobo train movie set near the Depression, right during the Depression. And it's got a gritty aesthetic to it that is very much lost, I think, on a lot of current filmmakers, and clearly a movie, a product of its time. But I was really excited that you shined a light on that movie, after I had discovered it, way after the fact. But it's such a gritty, nasty gem. And, look no further than Lee Marvin and Borgnine to just, grab the bull by the horns with those two roles and just kick the shit out of each other. It's really fun.
Yeah, I love that film. I got to a few years ago, I got to know Chris Knopf, who was the writer of the movie. And wonderful, wonderful guy. Did some incredible work on many other things over the years. I think that's probably his favorite, though. And we got to do a night at the American Cinematheque. We did a Q&A with him afterwards. It was a lot of fun. But yeah, that film's, it is. It's amazing. And it's such a, I don't know how you would make that today. I'm sort of in awe of it. I've always loved it. It was such a kick to get to know Chris and do that with him. And it's weird. I haven't watched my Blu-ray yet. It's like some movies shouldn't look that good.
Right?
It looks the Twilight Time. What I've been liking a lot of late that I have noticed, to the credit of Twilight Time, to the credit of Criterion, even on Blu-ray, some of these older movies are still retaining the grit and the grain, yeah. That celluloid look. And I've been really happy about that, because obviously we're in an age of digital cinematography a lot of the times now, and not many people are shooting on film. And, it feels like every other podcast I'm constantly bringing up the separation of, you know, the film world and the real world, and sitting down in a movie theater and watching a movie and, you know, having that, you know, I call it the sheen of cinema, you know, letting you get into a, you know, a filmed entertainment. And they have been making some of these older movies look as good as possible without turning them into, you know, digitally compromised versions of what they really were.
Yeah.
I think you'll be pleased. Basically, this is a long-winded way of saying I think you'll be pleased with the transfer on Gone. You know, I had never seen, you know, Emperor of the North at all in any form, but I was very shocked by how filmic the movie looked on Blu-ray.
Oh, good. Yeah. No, I agree. It's other than some, I remember when they restored Texas Chainsaw Massacre for the Laserdisc. And I remember thinking, this is wrong. I mean, every time I'd seen that film was, you know, really crappy print that was scratched to hell that looked like they found it on the floor of a slaughterhouse, you know. It's you can put all the grain in you want, but sometimes you need the scratches and the jumps and the melting the melting film. In fact, I think somebody on that would be a great app if you could you know, put on Blu-ray players a kind of random you know,
filter.
Scratches and melts and, you know, that would be awesome. Someone has to do that.
I watched Emperor of the North last night on Twilight Times Blu-ray.
Uh-huh.
And that was the first thing I thought of. It was just kind of like, whoa, this looks like how I don't think it should. But, I mean, I'm not complaining because it was a great picture. But, you know, I just kind of get thrown off sometimes when I'm, because I just bought a 4K TV not too long ago, and my Blu-ray collection's growing, and I just tend to buy everything on Blu-ray, and I still buy DVDs. But, yeah, it's just kind of this odd way of watching films that I was so accustomed to watching on
VHS. That may be a function.
VHS.
Okay, I'm not a huge fan of you know, HDTV in a lot of cases. I'm incredibly fortunate. Sort of my one big luxury is I have a digital projector, HD projector with a 12-foot by 5-foot screen. It's in scope ratio. And when you project Blu-rays, they look so bright. It's crazy. And then I can put the same Blu-ray on a TV, on HDTV. And there's just, even when you know what you're doing and you've made all the appropriate adjustments and everything, there's still this kind of, I don't know, there's a kind of weird clarity to Blu-rays that freaks me out on TVs. But, I don't know. Maybe it's better on 4K now. I don't know.
Yeah, I just bought it because it was too good to pass up when I saw the sale, and my old TV was kind of shitting out, so it was just kind of it just happened at the right time. But you're right when saying that, because I recently just I watched Bone Tomahawk, the new Kurt Russell horror western, which is great. I loved it.
Absolutely loved it.
But I'm watching it on my like 4K TV, and I'm just like, you know, this, I don't think it should look this good. You know, it should look grainy and scratchy, and like everything you're saying with like melty film and like film skipping and jumping on it, you know, it looked so John Ford-ish. It was crazy. Yeah. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you there. I don't know, but I'm guess I'm going to stick with 4K because they're going to do 4K Blu-rays next year or so.
And we've been, Josh, we've been really talking up Bone Tomahawk when we can, because Frank and I are both big fans, Frank especially. Did I hear you say that you had a chance to see it too? Because it is one of those underrated movies that sort of is under the radar for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic. I didn't expect anything, and was really knocked out, and so clearly done for almost no money. It's crazy. But yeah, it's a fantastic film. I mean, the great thing is it there's a decent chance it's not even going to be the best Western Kurt Russell is in this year.
Right.
Yeah. You know?
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
Which is saying something, because that film, holy shit, man.
And Frank and I are also, you know, we talk about this a lot, where, you know, we're always interested in movies that, you know, spin on their axis, or, you know, they become something at a certain point when you're least expecting it. And for me, that was one of the things about Bone Tomahawk that I really enjoyed, is that for a while you're getting one movie and then it kicks into a different gear and you get a different movie. And I think that sometimes that can take people by surprise, you know what I mean? And maybe turn some people off. But at the same time, for adventurous, you know, film lovers, a movie like Bone Tomahawk proves that you can take a milieu that you've seen before, a familiar one, and sort of spice it up in the right way.
For sure, for sure. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
And maybe we can ask you, because we were just talking about, you know, Bone Tomahawk in the West. You've got a project that you'd mentioned with Walter Hill, a Western, and that really raised both Frank and I's, you know, ears up. So what can you tell us about this project?
Next to nothing at this point. We're, a little bit, I guess. Warren Littlefield is producing it. I had a meeting with him. He mentioned that he had this Western. I'm a huge fan of Westerns. He was trying to develop for TV. It's great. I'd love to, you know, love to talk to you about it. They had a feature script that they thought would be really hard. It's just really hard to get Westerns made. They thought it would be really hard to get me a feature, but could be adapted into a TV show. I thought, all right, so you've got material. I'll read that. And he said, and it was written by Walter Hill, who will be an exec producer and directing the pilot. And I was like, are you kidding me? I'm totally kidding me. The only screenwriter whose work I actually studied when I was trying to figure out how to be a screenwriter. I love his work so much. And we're still in the process of developing it. And, you know, we're going to go out and pitch it and hopefully sell it. We'll see. But just getting to work with Walter has been just unreal. He's just hands down one of my favorite living filmmakers. That first run of six movies, you know, from Hard Times to 48 Hours, and building up to that by writing Hickey and Boggs and The Getaway, both of which are great movies. Talk about underrated. Hickey and Boggs. Is phenomenal.
Well, you had Busting by Peter Hyams, you had the Super Cops, you had Hickey and Boggs, you had that Freebie and the Bean, you had that great run of cop movies there, you know, back at those the precursor to the, you know, the modern buddy film, right?
Sure, sure. Oh, Freebie and the Bean is ground zero. That movie's amazing.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
That's another one I've been like completely obsessed with like all year is Freebie and the Bean. Yeah, I can't get over the vehicular mayhem in that movie, especially the sequence with James Caan on the motorbike at the end,
yep,
where he's just tearing shit up left and right. I freaked out a little bit earlier this year on The Stuntman. I had not seen The Stuntman with like mature movie watching eyes ever. I had seen bits and pieces of it like years ago, and it made no impression on me. And I was watching that film, and that's like a perfect movie to discuss. We could finish up with that one. Are you a fan of that one, Josh?
I love that film.
Yeah, that's just such an insane movie. And talk about a movie that obviously I can't even imagine what it was like making that movie then. Forget about it even trying to get made now.
I see. Yeah, there is I think he made a doc, Richard Rush, about the making of it, which was pretty interesting.
Yes. I still need to watch that.
Yeah, it was tough getting made then, but fantastic film. I love that. Yeah,
Frank and I went hard on the Richard Rush early in our podcasting endeavor.
Yes, okay. Nick introduced me to Color of Night, which I hadn't seen. And
can't go with you there, but
I became overly obsessed with that film for like a week and a half. I think I probably watched it like three or four times. It was like, I've never fucking seen anything like this in my entire life, and I never will. And it's just like this incoherent train wreck of a film, but it's just so enamoring at the same time. It's like, how the fuck did this get made?
Yep.
One thing I want to ask you before we wrap things up is I wanted to, have you seen a film called The Challenge? It's a Frankenheimer film with Scott Glenn.
Yeah, a long time ago.
I saw that Olive Film is putting it out on Blu-ray, and I was going to blind buy it because I love Scott Glenn and Toshiro Mifune and Frankenheimer, and the Blu-ray cover is so obnoxious with the with the cartoon drawing of Scott Glenn holding a samurai sword bare-chested, that this just looked like a film that was too good for me to pass up.
I remember, about all I remember is seeing it when it came out and not being overwhelmed with it. But that, I find, for a variety of reasons. I'm looking at it right now. I've got this, this German.
I mean, isn't that awesome?
Hilarious.
That cover?
Yeah. I bet it's better now than it was then. It's funny. Some films really do, the kind of just sort of, B-list odors that we used to crank out in this town, back then. You look at them now and they're better than some kind of, prestige projects. But I find some of them don't, though. I mean, you mentioned, like, we did Laughing Policeman recently at my movie night. And I had high hopes, even though I know that, when it came out, I was about as underwhelmed as you could be. And that film just did not get good with time.
It certainly didn't.
Still friggin' boring as hell. Although I did have one great line. What was it? God, who's his partner in it?
Bruce Dern.
Is it Bruce Dern? He says to the guy.
Yeah.
The cop says to the guy, there better be a sandwich in your pocket because whatever it is, I'm going to make you eat it.
That's another movie that's been sitting in my pile to watch the last like 4 or 5 months, and then I'm waiting to see it. So I guess I'll still keep it on my list, but I'll bump some other ones up in front of it.
I gotta say, yeah, Busting was a pretty huge disappointment too. We did that recently.
Oh, I enjoyed that one. I really liked
it. It was so fun to laugh at police, but I'll give it that. But it was just
what blows me away about Busting is the aesthetics. Mm-hmm. This is like pre-Steadicam. I have no idea how Peter Hyams did those shots in the hallway, the various chase sequences.
Sure.
I thought those were just amazing. And when you look at stuff that's so slick and glammed up these days, when you go back and see something like that, that's so rough and tumble, and yet, and that's one of the things I liked about Peter Hyams' work is that, like, he played in the rarefied B movie, the elevated B movie genre. He was making these great, really entertaining thrillers. But there was always this great sense of like physicality to his movies, something like Capricorn One, for instance, or, Outland. But I think, when was the last time you saw Busting? A while back or anytime recently?
Yeah, a long, long time ago.
I think the camera work especially.
2 weeks ago was the last time I saw it. But the first time I saw it was, probably when it came out.
Yeah.
I definitely, if I had to watch one of them again, I would watch Busting over Last Policeman. But I was hoping for more.
I probably, speaking for Frank, I could all night about underrated movies and everything, but we will we'll be respectful of the time that you have, and want to say thank you very much for chatting with us. It's been a real pleasure, and hopefully kick-ass Josh Olson stuff coming up in the near future.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks, man. Anytime you want to come back on, talk about a new project, or talk about an underrated film, you are more than welcome to. It would be our honor to have you back.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, man, I'd be remiss to not ask you, since we've spent an hour together, will you just read my fucking screenplay? I'm sure you've heard that 1,000 times.
No,
sorry.
No one's ever asked. You're so clever.
I know. I got to pat myself on the back. But seriously, man, thank you so very much for coming on.
That was fun. You guys take care.
Lots of fun.
All right.
All right, man. Thanks.